It is a pleasure to introduce our next instructor here at Best Ideas 2018. Joining us all the way from Sydney, Australia, Joe Megger is Chief Investment Officer of Lake House Capital. He is also the Portfolio Manager of the Lake House Small Companies Fund and the Lake House Global Growth Fund. Joe has been with the Motley Fool's family of companies for more than a decade. He previously served as Director of Research at the Motley Fool Australia, as well as the portfolio manager of Australia's Motley Fool Pro, a real money portfolio with a long-only Australian Securities Exchange spending mandate. Before making the leap to Australia, Joe served as the lead advisor of Motley Fool Inside Value. On behalf of the MOI Global community, a very warm welcome. Please proceed.
Thanks, Shai. Great to be here. I'm excited. And I really appreciate the invitation to participate. So I'm excited to walk you through very quickly. Here's a disclaimer, which I encourage everyone to read, and I'll continue to move on. But tell you about one of my favorite ideas and very briefly just tell you a little bit more about Lake House, and then we can roll into the fun stuff. So Lake House Capital, it's a business that we started in 2016. You can think of it as the funds management arm of the Motley Fool Australia. We manage about $200 million in assets between our two funds here in Australia. As you can tell from the accent, I'm an American, but I've been here in Sydney for about 5 years now, coming up on. Stylistically, and I think this is going to set the tone for the idea, so it's important to cover this stuff up front. We are very long-term oriented. We are low turnover. We're not traders in any capacity or market timers. We don't have any conviction that we can do those things well. We're also fairly high conviction investors. So our two funds respectively will typically hold 15 to 30 and 20 to 40 positions at a time. So we're very comfortable backing our best ideas, play to win, not to draw. And we are also, our active share is quite high. So for our small companies fund, for example, our benchmark has approximately 2% in IT, and about two thirds of our invested capital within that fund is in IT. So our active share is about maximum for the small cap fund. We're very comfy with that. And I think a lot of people would look at our fund and say, wow, you know, you guys are two thirds IT, this is an IT fund, but we don't think of it that way at all. Now we view ourselves as having very specific parameters that we're looking for in companies. And when we very critically run through those, it just so happens that a lot of those companies end up being e-commerce companies or software companies, typically enterprise software. And so that's where we end up focusing a lot of our capital, and where the idea that I'm going to talk about today kind of fits that mold. In terms of what we look for, a lot of this will probably be familiar to a lot of investors, but I would just say that we are dogmatic about certain parts of these. First is strong positions in growing markets. We don't like melting ice cubes. We don't like third tier players. We like leaders within spaces that have room to run. Pricing power is something we look for just as being indicative of moat and strength and durability and being in a good place in the value chain. Durable competitive advantages, I'm probably not going to have to sell anyone on that, but we are picky about what we consider to be durable. Aligned experienced management teams, I'll just add, we think in terms of the company's track record with capital allocation as well, which of course can vary depending on how long the company's been around for. A lot of our smaller companies, there's not a lot to work with, but we do focus quite a bit on alignment. Conservative balance sheets, this is one that will vary company to company, industry to industry, but we like to sleep well knowing that companies are well capitalized. And attractive valuations, of course, I consider myself a value investor. That said, you'll notice the last point on the list, and we are not dogmatic value investors. We're not always focused on statistically cheap companies. The company I'm talking about today is not statistically cheap. If that's just a total deal breaker for you, then now might be a good time to move on to another session. But we think it's an opportunity that has quite a bit of room to run and multiple legs up for growth. So all that said, very quickly, you know, our two funds, about a third of our capital is in the global fund, which we just launched last month. In November, focused mid and large developed markets. The small companies fund, which is currently closed, focused on smalls in Australia and New Zealand. Those might look like very different strategies, but underpinning them is a very similar philosophy, and there's quite a bit of spillover. So moving on, the idea. The idea that I want to talk about today is Afterpay Touch. So Afterpay Touch Group, some quick facts. It's listed on the ASX. It's based in Melbourne, and it was formed in June 2017 via merger between Afterpay and Touch Corp, which I'm going to talk about in a bit. A little bit of market data. It's big enough for small funds to dip their toes in my opinion. If you're someone who needs $10 million in daily liquidity, I feel sorry for you, first of all. But secondarily, that's probably not going to be the case here, and unless hopefully it grows into having that sort of liquidity. One important thing I'll just say, I know there are probably going to be a lot of Americans watching, all currency references here in Aussie dollars, and the Aussie dollar is around 76 cents on the USD, just to give you a little bit of context. All right, so Afterpay Touch can be thought of as really two different businesses, and I'm going to focus significantly on the Afterpay part because we think it's going to be the huge majority of not just revenue, but the overall value pie for this fiscal year, but also progressively more so going forward. So Afterpay is a pay later business. It is a payment option that you would encounter in a digital world similar to a PayPal, which is a business I like and I own personally. You can pay with PayPal at more than, I'm sorry, with Afterpay at more than 10,000 different online retailers in Australia and now New Zealand. The basic premise and how it's different than a PayPal is that when you pay with Afterpay, this same transaction happens, you get your stuff, all the same normal things happen, except that you then pay Afterpay back over the course of four interest-free fortnightly installments. Fortnightly, for my fellow Americans, is every 2 weeks. So essentially, you're getting interest-free float on that transaction. I use it for that reason, and a lot of other people do. So the company now has more than 1.3 million users in Australia. For context, there are only 25 million people in Australia. So this is quite a bit of traction. And it's gained quite a bit of steam, and now with more than 10,000 merchants across Australia and New Zealand. There's also Touch. Touch is the payment processing platform underneath Afterpay that assesses fraud and risk at the transaction level. It's an important part of the stack. It also has about $25 million in external revenue from external customers other than Afterpay. So it is a contributor, certainly, to the business financially and strategically. All right, so the big idea with this thesis is summed up in a few points. The first is just there's significant growth here. So Afterpay has gone from being founded 3 calendar years ago to having more than 1 million users. That is a pretty stupendous growth rate, and we'll talk more about that in a bit. Second is there is a strong and strengthening network effect. We're seeing rapid growth in users, merchants, and importantly, spend per user, which to me is the ultimate indication of the health and trajectory of a network effect, is engagement per user. And here you would think of that as in terms of spend, which is up 28% year over year. Afterpay also has multiple irons in the fire, not in a stretched, we don't know what our business model kind of way, but in what we consider to be very logical adjacencies to the core market that they've been building in Australia, namely gaining share within that category, but also additional verticals going into real world storefronts, which they've already done, and going abroad. And we'll speak to each of those in a bit. And overall, I think it's a business that has attractive unit level economics, low net transaction loss rates, and high capital velocity. Again, we'll dig into that. So some recent history. Afterpay was founded in 2014, IPO roughly 2 years later. Co-founders, we'll talk about them in a bit. We've met with them a few times, Anthony and Nick Molnar. What's interesting about this is that Afterpay was seeded and supported by Touch Corp out of the gate. So Touch Corp's model was kind of interesting and quirky. The company had this tech stack of risk assessment software, and they had customers, but they also had this idea of, well, what if we provide this platform and some capital to seed other tech startups or fintechs, and they can build on top of our stack. In exchange, we'll get paid in equity, and if it works out, great. While that might be clever in a private market context, it might. The public market hated it, and Touch Corp at the time of the announced merger was actually roughly a net at the time, and it was selling for around the value of its stake in Afterpay. So the market really didn't like the strategy. Something else going on that didn't help, and why I think overall, this merger made great strategic sense. The CEO of TouchCorp had died suddenly recently as well, which is obviously terrible. So from a TouchCorp perspective, there was quite a bit of likely desire to move on and merge. It helps that Touch was a huge investor in Afterpay. And to flip it around to the other side, Afterpay's business was sitting on top of the engine of TouchCorp's transaction assessment software. And for us, we considered that a pretty significant structural risk. And we didn't invest in either of these companies until after the merger was announced, in which case we think that Afterpay significantly de-risked its business by having full control of that stack. So here's a little bit about Afterpay, a little more how it works and how it's different than a lot of other payment options. So this is a screenshot of David Jones, probably not a household name in America, but it's the largest, one of the largest department stores here in Australia. What's interesting is if you check out that pink arrow, you can see that David Jones is saying, hey, you can pay $7.99 for the suit or four nightly interest-free payments of $199.75 with Afterpay. Now, what's really unusual here, and you might have already crossed your mind, is that David Jones is actively promoting a payment option at the shop page experience. They don't wait until you get to the checkout. They're actively saying, hey, use Afterpay. We're going to talk about why that is, but the short answer is, and you can probably discern, they really like Afterpay because it's driving better conversion and it's driving bigger basket sizes, bigger order sizes. But it's really unusual to see this kind of thing, and it helps explain why Afterpay has just accelerated so quickly. So to that acceleration, Afterpay essentially had no users 2 years ago. And as of September, it was up to 1.1 million. They're now past 1.3. They're adding 3,000 users a day. On the merchant side, again, they had almost none 2 years ago and over 8,000 as of September, now over 10,000, and they're adding about 30 a week. So that's discrete merchants, I should say, not storefronts. So that is quite a bit of traction for such a young business. All right, so here's another way to kind of get some scope on how quickly Afterpay is growing and how it looks in a relative context. So this is a chart from Google Trends. There's a lot of nuance to this chart, and I don't really want to get too far into the weeds. The important part is that blue line, interest in Afterpay, is rocketing hard up and to the right. And you can see ZipPay below. ZipPay is a competitor to Afterpay here in Australia. I'm not really going to spend much time on it because Afterpay is much larger and I think has a better strategy. And to be blunt, it's growing faster and it's significantly larger, growing faster. It's a little hard to unpack some of Zip's numbers because they have different parts of the business, different offerings. I think Zip could be interesting, but overall, if I'm going to back a network, I certainly want to back the biggest network effect within the space. And Afterpay is certainly proving itself. And PayPal, I just have there to give some context as a benchmark. Obviously, and I'll talk more about this, PayPal is larger in terms of the number of users in Australia, but it just gives you some sense that Afterpay is really gaining a lot of traction. Okay, so to get back a little more to the kind of the experience of how this works, retailers are actively promoting using Afterpay. So these are screenshots that I took on Black Friday, which is a thing in Australia too, which is one of many things that Americans have exported. What's fascinating here is Country Road and David Jones, two very big retailers within Australia, on their homepages, the first thing after their logo is that they're promoting using Afterpay. Now, this is free space. Afterpay is not paying for that placement, and Afterpay isn't actively trying to get merchants to even join their platform. It's all inbound demand from merchants coming to them because merchants are so happy using them. Merchants have even asked them to try to sign longer term deals than the current arrangements because they're so concerned about Afterpay potentially jacking up prices on them. So I think that speaks very well to how retailers view this relationship and how happy they are working with Afterpay. So the value prop, there's consumer and merchants. On the consumer side, buy now, pay later. So I use Afterpay, and I have to admit, the first time I heard about Afterpay, I was like, why would I use that? I can just pay with PayPal. I mean, essentially, it's just as fast. I'll just pay with PayPal. But the investor in me is like, well, if I can pay now, or if I can buy now, and I can pay interest-free over 8 weeks, and you're just going to yank that money from a card that I've set up with the account, which 85% of people have linked debit cards to Afterpay. The other have done credit cards. I'm not going to pay interest. Yeah, okay. I'll take that float. Probably don't have to sell anyone on that listening. And that probably explains why it's grown so quickly. Afterpay is a very straightforward experience. There's no interest, no establishment fees, and it's now quite widely accepted. Merchants, on the other side, there are many who have seen bigger orders and basket sizes. And to be honest, I think the ultimate evidence of that and proof is you've got major retailers actively promoting this right at the top of their homepage on huge shopping days. Higher conversion rates, which I wrote conversation rates. Hey, let's talk about it. Eliminate chargebacks. Chargebacks are a big pain point for retailers where for a variety of reasons, credit card companies or banks come back to them and say, hey, this transaction didn't work out. It's annoying for merchants and costly, whereas this model with Afterpay, the merchant pays a flat fee, which on average comes out to 4.1% to Afterpay for handling the transaction. And then it's on Afterpay to handle any fraud, chargebacks, issues, whatever, it's on them. Retailers like that cleanliness. It also makes layaway programs simpler. Layaway is kind of a thing here in Australia. It's called lay-by. And of course, it's popular with consumers. So I think Afterpay has reached a critical mass here now with more than 1.3 million consumers where it starts to get difficult to be a retailer here online and not accept something that's growing so quickly. And for context, Afterpay estimates that they now have about 20% of online fashion spend is through Afterpay. And about 5% of total Australian e-commerce or online retail is flowing through Afterpay. So that's pretty significant growth in a short amount of time. All right, so here's why I think this could keep rolling. And there are self-reinforcing dynamics here, which get me excited as an investor. And I'm gonna talk about them separately. So on the left, we essentially have the network effect component. This isn't gonna be startling to anyone's experience, but essentially more merchants who come on the platform attracts more users, which drives more transactions. And I think the proof in the pudding, aside from just the obvious growth rates, is that rising spend per user is up 28% year on year, which is pretty remarkable. And I think that given the huge increase in the number of merchants over the past several months, that number is going to keep ticking higher at pretty healthy rates. And for what it's worth, I spent a lot of time looking at network businesses, and I think that rising engagement or spend per user is the measure that best defines the trajectory of a network. And I think being up 28% is very strong. All right, let's move over to the one on the right. These are certainly related, but we're going to talk about more transactions driving more data. So you have more information on individual users, merchants, items, locations, area codes, all making you more intelligent, feeding into smarter lending. So unlike other lenders, now I would think of Afterpay as a payments company that lends. Whereas I would think of something like a ZipPay, which is a rival here, is a finance company that is a payment option. It's a different approach to the transaction. And frankly, there's a lot more fine print with Zip's approach. There's interest. It's a lot more complex. The smarter lending part is more data flows through, the better Afterpay is at pricing risk at each transaction that it evaluates. I'm going to talk more about transaction in a bit. But the key proof point here for me is that despite this rapid growth, we've seen falling net transaction loss rates. Now, this is a really important point because I know a lot of people here are probably half the people here are like me own Markel or Berkshire. And there's probably a pretty good understanding of the challenges around pricing insurance and long tail financial pricing and risk. So for example, workers' comp insurance, it's hard to tell whether or not you're writing a good policy there because it's going to be many, many years before it'll come back to bite you if you've been too aggressive. In this case, Afterpay's receivables book turns over every 30 days. So there's a very short duration transactions. Now, because of that, Afterpay is able to very quickly see whether or not things are working or they're not. So if you're looking at a traditional bank or an insurer that's had Afterpay's kind of growth, to be honest, I probably would be totally hands off with it and not interested because I would say, geez, it's going to be a long time before we can see whether this is working. But because of the velocity here, Afterpay is pretty quickly able to tell how well the loan book's doing and the fact that net transaction loss rates have actually been falling in the face of higher acceptance rates per transaction, I think really speaks to that dynamic on the right. So broadly as well, what I think through there is that as Afterpay continues to gain scale, their algorithms will get much smarter and it'll be that much more of a competitive edge. All right, so talking about how they actually assess each transaction. Afterpay is different in that when you join Afterpay as a user, they don't run a credit check on you. There's not like a FICO score that they go check. They assess you based on a variety of factors, some of which are public. I suspect most of which are not, which I'll talk about in a bit, the known ones through proprietary algorithms. Now, unlike, let's say, a Citi where you go, you get a credit card, and they give you essentially just a limit, a line of credit, you can go out and buy whatever you want. Afterpay assesses each transaction at the point of sale in real time. So it's a very different model, and a variety of factors go into helping them decide whether or not that's a transaction they can approve. They actually reject, they try to do it gracefully, 25% of transactions at the point of sale. I should say this is enhanced by TouchCorp customers. I'll try to make this quick, but Optus is a major phone company here in Australia. Touch powers the Optus fraud and risk assessment platform for prepaid phones. So if it turns out that someone does a naughty thing with a credit card over at Optus, that's something that Touch is going to know, and it's going to inform the Afterpay algorithms as well. So I've already mentioned these transaction statistics, but about a quarter of transactions are rejected on the spot, 80% of transactions by value by returning customers are done by returning customers, and transactions are linked to cards, so not bank accounts. That could change in the future as Afterpay gains scale, and it would certainly save them a few bucks to go direct into bank accounts, but overwhelmingly it's linked to debit cards. So transaction integrity engine, think of this as the flywheel, and these are the different factors, some of which are known, and there's probably a lot more they're not going to tell you about, that drive their ability to correctly price risk, to put this in kind of nerdy insurer inside baseball talk. Location, it's a factor in helping them assess in real time whether there's a good chance that they're going to get paid. The merchant, different merchants have different levels of fraud rates. Item, so this is a crucial one. You would think, now if you got a Citi credit card, you know, they don't particularly care what it is you're buying exactly, but Afterpay does, because there are very different rates of fraud related to different items. So for example, let's say you're talking about buying a new iPhone or some sort of widely used consumer electronic. There is a very liquid secondary market for those items online, and as such, fraud is pretty high for them. Contrast that to, let's say, a purple polka dot dress in a certain size. The secondary market for that dress is not going to be very liquid. So Afterpay looks at those and says, we're going to be much more lenient in approving the transaction for the purple polka dot dress of a certain size than we are for the iPhone. I think it's an important factor that people don't necessarily appreciate. Card history, fairly obvious. User history, also fairly obvious. And if you're behind on a payment for another item with Afterpay, they won't let you buy another one. They don't want to let you get dig yourself into a hole. User address history. So here's another interesting one. If someone in your apartment, let's say you've got three roommates, and one of them has an Afterpay customer, and they buy something and they end up not paying Afterpay back, and you happen to go sign up for Afterpay, that's going to end up dinging you. And the reason is they're just aware that there's a higher degree of risk around that. Operating system, I just say all this, there are a lot of different factors and many more that they don't want to talk about because of secret sauce. But I think it's interesting and it helps them price all that risk. All right, this is an important slide, which I'm going to go through faster than I'd like, but I think it's really important, so work with me. All right, on the left, essentially we've got the existing market focus, which is Australian online retail. So they're adding almost 30 merchants a week. PayPal, in terms of scope, has 6 million plus users in Australia. These guys have 1.3 million. Now, granted, PayPal's a different offering, but I think that it speaks to there being a lot of upside to getting more customers. Afterpay has been very focused on millennial shoppers, and it's become its own verb in Australia among young people. Like, you don't just buy it, you Afterpay it. You know, obviously that's a cool and a nice little yardstick. I think that's going to continue to expand beyond millennials, just like you see a lot of networks do. And again, higher spend per user. All right, on the right, adjacent drivers. So again, not throwing stuff at the wall, but moving out in very specific adjacent markets and options. Australians, I should say overall, particularly Australian tech companies, are far more conservative than American tech companies in terms of how they go after new markets and how they manage risk and their balance sheets. There's just less of a culture of risk taking here, which gives me comfort. So new verticals. They're working on a travel pilot right now with Jetstar. Jetstar is the value offering from Qantas, which is the flagship Australian air company. Probably a lot of you familiar with Qantas. The company hasn't given firm numbers on how that pilot is going, but they did expand the scope of the pilot, which I think speaks well. We'll find out more early next year, I suspect, on what those numbers look like. The company's also moving further away from its core apparel. They're now more department stores, discount stores. There's an auto parts chain that now accepts Afterpay, and I think you'll see progressive moves out there. And I should say travel, by the way, online travel is a huge category, which probably a lot of you appreciate. And I think if they can crack that nut effectively and profitably, and my hunch is they will, that opens a lot of potential. So the next one, new markets. They've moved into New Zealand. Again, this move happened fairly recently, a few months ago. They did it with a lodge partner, which is Trade Me, which is 800-pound gorilla of Australian e-commerce. We don't have an update on how that's progressing, but if you look at Google Trends data for Afterpay in New Zealand, you can see a pretty sharp up and to the right, which I take as a positive. Moving to in-store, oh, and new markets, I should say. They've said that they're looking to expand internationally. They haven't really focused on naming names outside of New Zealand, but of course, I think the US is a logical market. And I'll just add that, as I'll talk about in a minute, I don't think someone is doing what Afterpay is doing in the States, or at least effectively or at scale. And in-store retail. So in-store retail within the market that we think is relevant to these guys, mainly fashion, clothing, is about 5x the online retail opportunity. So it's a big one. PayPal, business I own, like, has struggled to crack that nut for years, but Afterpay seems to have good traction. By Christmas, it's expected to be in 4,000 different storefronts. And again, we'll find out more early next year on how that's progressing. But the company did give, and this is just one anecdote, but one store here called Tony Bianca Stores, they found that within 4 to 6 weeks of rolling out Afterpay within their physical stores, 12% of the value of transactions was flowing through Afterpay. So we consider this an in-the-money call option because it's riding the rails of the existing infrastructure with existing partners, and it could be a very big opportunity. So management team, I'll kind of go through this quickly. Anthony Eisen, a very well-known guy here in Sydney and Australia, successful executive, interesting background, and executive chairman. And I'll say broadly, there's a difference in Australia where chairmen are more engaged with businesses than they are in the States. Nick Molnar, young guy, CEO of Afterpay, he's really pushing that business. Very sharp, has done some entrepreneurial stuff in the past. We like them as a great duo, and Anthony's the guy that you kind of wheel out to talk to the financial nerds, and Nick is the product guy. But they're a good duo. They own almost a quarter of the business between them. Neither of them sold into the IPO and committed to a 2-year escrow. I wouldn't be shocked if either of them took some chips off the table come May to buy a house on Sydney Harbour, which is quite beautiful. But overall, there's a lot of skin in the game for these guys, a lot of passion for the business as well when you talk to them. And when you look at the opportunity ahead and how young Nick is, he's the youngest CEO that I've personally met with. I think that there's a lot of room to run here and reason to be happy with this team. So, talking about unit-level economics. On average, there's a blended take rate of about 4.1%. For context, PayPal's in the mid to low threes, at net transaction margin around 2.5%, net transaction loss rate of 0.6%. I'm skipping some stuff there in the middle just because I can't cover everything. Importantly, net transaction loss rates, Strikehouse is quite low relative to other peers you might find, and that the trajectory is down at the right, which we're happy with. It is a little hard to compare loss rates across peers because there isn't really a public comp who has a model like Afterpay's. That net transaction loss rate basically is the amount that they don't get paid back netted off against late fees. And late fees, which the company very transparently tells you you'll receive if you fall behind on your payments, roughly shake out to about a quarter of merchant fees overall, just to give some scope. So there is a meaningful part of the business that's netting there in terms of late fees. And the balance sheet, again, recycling capital pretty quickly. The company got a credit line from major Australian bank about a year ago, and that has been increased, I want to say, 3 or 4 times in the past year. So clearly the bank's happy, and it gives them quite a bit of capacity and scale with that $370 million facility when they're recycling their capital basically 12 times a year. So you can kind of 12x that credit facility and say, well, this is what that credit facility could top out at in terms of annual transaction value. All right, so this is just a quick breakdown on our forecast of what the revenue mix looks like for FY18. Fiscal year in Australia ends June 30. So this would be June 30, 2018. For that year, we think Afterpay merchant fees are be almost 80% of the business, and certainly more going forward. This probably explains more why we haven't talked too much about TouchCorp. The huge bulk of TouchCorp's revenue, by the way, is based on transactions related to multi-year contracts. So we think that's a pretty solid, stable business. It's not the part we're excited about, but if you're going to be the little gray part, it's a good little gray part. So operating financial data, I'm going to kind of there's a lot of numbers here. I'll focus on the important parts. Afterpay merchant fees, we expect, will be up around 300% this year, which is pretty striking. And that's faster than user growth because spend per user is accelerating. TouchCorp revenue, we assume, is probably going to be similar to the previous year, although the last time the company spoke to investors on conference call, it's not like things are going well. Could be growth there, but yeah, sure, we'll just assume it's flat. Afterpay Touch total revenue for the year, we're looking for around something like 117 for the year. That's 141% growth year on year. That's above the small consensus that exists. Depends on whose numbers you're looking at, but there are only 4 analysts that cover this, and there are kind of different ways that different light items are treated. So consensus is not really easily assessed, but overall we think there's a pretty clear growth trajectory here, and they could be going on for some time. So valuation. I'm a value investor. I like underpaying for things. Problem here is that there's no clear framework for value in this business. It's not conventionally cheap by any measure. It didn't post statutory profit last year. This year, they will be consensus. Again, this is a very small consensus, is that the shares are selling on 35 times FY19 earnings per share, adjusted, which probably backs out SBC. I wouldn't read too much into that, but that's the consensus. If that were to hold, then I think these shares would be very attractively priced. There are no ready public market comps. Fairly unique model. The best example is Zip, but again, Zip has a different approach. You could look at EV to Rev, but that's kind of complicated because this is a big part of the business is lending. Lenders and notoriously difficult to value in financials. Did I mention this was complicated? So one way we tried to frame this was, well, let's look at a private market comp. So we looked at a firm. So some of you might be familiar with a firm. It's a business, a payments business co-founded by Max Levchin, probably best known for co-founding PayPal with Peter Thiel. The business started 2 years before Afterpay, but as best we can tell is smaller and doesn't have the trajectory that Afterpay does, despite Afterpay being in a market that is 1/13th the size of the United States in population. Afterpay has more than 10,000 merchants. Last disclosure I've seen, which pretty recent, as a firm was over 1,200. I haven't seen a disclosed user number for a firm. It might be out there, but I haven't seen it. Afterpay's got more than 1.3 million people. Volume, in terms of number of loans, now this is a little bit Pink Lady apples and Granny Smith apples because a firm's loans are 3, 6 to 12 months, so longer term than Afterpay's, which rotate every 30 days on average. But even if you make nip tucks for that and assume, well, it's six, let's say it's an average 6 month tenor for a firm, there's still more transactions that it seems have flowed through Afterpay, or even if you said it was comparable, again, we'll keep flowing down to the valuation. I entered second country. A firm has said they're interested in doing that. Personally, I think it's a strategic mistake because they haven't buttoned down their home market yet. But anyway, Afterpay has succeeded in their home market and has moved into a second market already, New Zealand. Okay, so the valuation. A firm just did another capital raise that, according to reports, and when you convert into Aussie dollars, brought the value of the company about $2 to $2.6 billion. Afterpay Touch, encompassing the whole Afterpay Touch group business, market value is $1.2 billion market cap. So is this a difficult value business? Yes, very much so. But I also think that given the ways to win, that I can live with that. And when you look at what I think is probably the cleanest comp, albeit a difficult one, this is certainly, I think, a significantly better opportunity than what some sophisticated VCs are paying for a firm today, or to participate in a firm. So risks, put this at the end, but obviously important. There's execution risk when you're growing rapidly. The pushes internationally may not work. So far, the company's gracefully handled that. Recession in Australia, of course, any company that has credit risk faces challenge. If there's a recession, loss rates go up. Not everybody needs that purple polka dot address during a tough time. I will say, though, that one important nuance to this is that a lot of people have looked at Afterpay Touch and they say something like, well, you know, let's say there's a recession and net loss rates double or triple, you know, that could really hamper the business. Maybe they have to raise capital. There's a really important bit of nuance here, which is that because the loan book is rolled over every 30 days, and because each transaction is processed and assessed in real time, the company will know very quickly if the economy is softening, and they can pivot very quickly and tweak their algorithms to change what levels of risk they're willing to assess per transaction. They've said that new users are by far the contributor of loss rates. So if there was a tough time, the simplest thing they could do is just tighten the reins a bit on new users. And so I think because you're doing that dynamically and that loan book rolls every 30 days, it's too simplistic and not realistic to just put a multiple on a loss rate, assuming something around a recession. Again, not to say that a recession wouldn't sting, but I just think those are important bits of nuance to consider. And regulatory. So the space at large is being looked at by ASIC, which is like the SEC of Australia. The reason is that it's growing very quickly and they just want to make sure everything's on the up and up for a variety of reasons. Well, so what could come of that? It's a little bit hard to say. Afterpay could be forced to get a credit license. They might be forced to become a bank. They might have some sort of capital requirements. It might affect their ability to charge late fees, might force them to do credit checks on application. It's open-ended. And I think that has kept the stock from doing more than what I think its growth speaks to. And this review probably is going to go on for another year, by the way. But I think there are a few factors that really work in Afterpay's favor. For one, they don't charge interest. Two, yes, they do charge late fees, but show me another consumer finance company that doesn't charge late fees. Three, they don't run credit checks on people, but given the low loss rates, it's hard to argue that they are inaccurately pricing risk. Four, if you're behind on a payment for one item, they won't lend you for another. Five, they don't announce or tell exactly how much they're willing to lend to someone, but my impression based on what I've seen from retailers who will put out numbers is it's not a huge number at a time. So they're not going to let you run off and rack up $20,000 worth of purchases. It's some fraction of that, small fraction. Finally, I'll just add, consumers seem to really like the product given the rate of growth. And there's actually a Facebook group, which is unaffiliated to the company, called We Love Afterpay, that has more than 100,000 users. So these are people that I guess they really love Afterpay and they like it and follow it on Facebook. And this is all just totally a thing that they do on their own. So we'll see how that shakes out. That to me is probably the biggest structural risk here, but we're comfy with it given the level of growth. Of course, other risks exist, really annual, but those are the big ones. So to kind of hit the main points here and then I'll turn it over for questions. Company's gone from zero to more than a million users in just over 3 years. I think there's a strong network effect. I think it's getting stronger, and I think there's proof around that. There are different ways for this business to scale within the existing vertical they're in, but also adjacent ones, and I find that quite exciting. And last, again, low transaction loss rates and the high capital velocity is something that I think is probably going to be underestimated by a lot of investors. So I'll stop there and I'll just turn it over for any questions.
Joe, a big thank you for sharing such in-depth analysis on such a unique off-the-beaten-path idea. That was eye-opening and really beautiful. I'd love to move back
Thank you.
to slide number 11, which I believe is about 14 slides earlier, I think. So let's go back a few slides. Specifically, I think two slides earlier, maybe. Correct? Yeah, the J curve, if we could. One forward.
This guy.
Correct. As I'm trying to understand the unit economics and perhaps building out a cash flow model of some kind, I'm imagining the metrics that matter might be CAC, customer acquisition cost, churn, lifetime value. Is that the right way to start thinking about this, or are these not the right
Yeah,
metrics?
it's a great question. So, yes and no. So, it's not really a SaaS business. And in terms of customer acquisition costs, the company is spending next to nothing on merchant acquisition. And in terms of marketing overall, they spend, I don't believe I've actually seen an ad for Afterpay. I would believe that some exist, but the huge driver of growth has been organic, which is typical and what you hope to see with a lot of networks, unlike a lot of small networks that basically have to try to buy their way into growth. I think if you're a network-driven business and you're having to buy customers aggressively to make it work, that's probably a sign that it's not working and it's not going to make it. But in this case, this growth has been overwhelmingly organic. Churn is, yeah, so I guess I'd say the traditional SaaS metrics are kind of out the window. I mean, you could probably try to get cute with some lifetime value measures around users, given that there is a fair bit of visibility into loss rates and their net transaction margins and merchant fees and spend per user. So that would probably be where I'd start if I was trying to do an LTV calc at the user level. But overall, it is a quite difficult one to stick into a DCF.
And I think to ask another question, just throwing metrics at you to see how you react. I'm wondering if the company is cash flow positive, and if the answer is no, to what degree there's visibility on the balance sheet's long-term solvency.
Yeah, good question. So last year they posted a positive EBITDA. So the I is included further up, and they're trying to exclude SBC, but on a cash basis it was. But there are different things going on there related to the acquisition as well. Looking forward to this current fiscal year, the expectation is that on a cash basis they will be cash flow positive. So they sh should be in pretty decent shape there. And I'll just say too that their lender, they've got this what is a pretty large credit facility with NAB, which is a major Australian bank. And I think there's probably some degree of trust we can take that facility would not have gotten so large so quickly if there wasn't a good bit of confidence around their ability to reach that critical mass of profitability.
And as I'm hearing you share this idea, which is really fascinating, it almost sounds like it's publicly traded venture capital in a positive sense.
Yeah, that's a very good way to put it.
And if that's the case, why is the company public and not privately backed?
Yeah, great question. So the VC market in Australia is very thin. There aren't, it's for a few reasons. So overall, Australia is a country where people are comfortable taking risk. It gambles more per capita than any other country in the world. And you got a lot of wildcatters and some very successful miners and real estate titans. But in terms of tech, it's just never been a huge part of the market. And there aren't many meaningful VC funds here. And while there have been some investments from American VCs here in the region, they're few and far between. So if you want to get funding here in Australia for a venture idea, you can either bootstrap it, like, I mean, Atlassian did, and they bootstrapped their business with a credit card, but that is a true unicorn that rides a dragon kind of business. I mean, it's just amazing economics. Otherwise, you might be able to get VC money, but otherwise, you may just have to turn to public markets. and let them be your source of capital? So it's a very good question. I think if this was in the States, then it would almost certainly still be private and probably stay that way for some time. But it's just a different structure in the capital market here.
I may be projecting my own bias and possibly giving a speech as opposed to asking a question, but let me throw this at you anyway. We heard Chamath, who's the CEO and founder of Social Capital, speak at LatticeWork 2017 in September 2017. And he touched upon the fact he's raising a SPAC to do some very interesting public-private nuances. To what degree do you worry about someone like Chamath or the equivalent of him locally doing some type of control takeover and capturing the upside without your consent?
It's a reasonable question. I mean, I guess if I'm thinking about upside here, I would be pretty disappointed if these guys sold to like a PayPal would be a logical acquirer, given that they tend to buy a lot of stuff. This fits in their wheelhouse, and they just changed their approach with PayPal Credit, where they're taking that risk off their balance sheet. Maybe they could use that model as well to handle the credit risk here with Afterpay. Maybe they could bring it to the States and scale it themselves. This is one that I would like to see the thesis run. I think given how young Nick is, I want to say he's late 20s, he's probably not in a big rush to move on. So that's my hope. Structurally, I do think we're going to see a lot more. I don't know. I think the creation of those SPACs, or you look at the name escapes me, but that massive fund that was raised in Asia recently that's now just devouring private companies is changing the nature of VC. But I don't think that's probably going to land here. Yeah, SoftBank. I don't think that model's going to hit here anytime soon.
And if we can move ahead one slide, please, slide 12. My understanding of the PayPal history is that there was a merger early in the development between PayPal and X.com. To what degree might history rhyme where there is a reason for Afterpay and ZipPay to combine forces?
Yeah, good question. I would not be shocked if that happened. If anything, I think the tricky part would be for Afterpay to get excited about partnering with Zip, because they have such a bigger base of merchants and users. And the other thing is that Zip's market, their approach is quite different. It's essentially a finance product that offers a payment option. And they also have Zip Pay, which is the payment competitor. Then they also have Zip Money, which is kind of a revolving credit line. So it would introduce a lot of noise into Afterpay to put them together. They still could. I mean, they could merge and say, all right, we're going to transition ZipPay's model into that we have of Afterpay. But I think that it probably just makes sense for them to keep running away with the market. And Zip, by the way, recently took on a strategic investment from Westpac, which is a pretty huge bank here. And to me, I think they did that out of a position of weakness, because they felt like they needed the capital. And this is my impression. They needed the capital to compete and throw more at trying to catch up with Afterpay, who's running away with the market. But I think it also boxes them in a little bit in terms of their future. When you're so tightly aligned with one bank, and for context, in Australia, there are four big banks called the Four Pillars. So it's possible that could happen, but I think Zip, going back in time, PayPal and X, the product was so similar that it made it a lot cleaner than what would be here.
And I can't help but notice on this slide you have that the line of Afterpay appears to be the same level as the line of PayPal, and they're both somewhere in the ballpark of 75 or 100. To what degree is there any relevance that these numbers are in the same magnitude, if any?
Yeah, I would think of it in very broad terms, because, for example, you know, PayPal is used by a lot more people in Australia, a lot of people who don't necessarily need to search for PayPal. And you, when you might get to a checkout experience, you see PayPal and you just pay for it there. You don't need to do a lot of Googling around for it. So I wouldn't read too much into, you know, the comparison of what that means. I will say that the proportions of interest for Afterpay versus Zip broadly in terms of transaction value actually are pretty comparable, roughly. But I would think of it more as just an indicator that Afterpay has gained a lot of steam and that PayPal's level of interest in the market has been fairly static over time, like modest growth, but that in wallet share that Afterpay is gaining quite a bit.
I definitely love the thesis of a network effect, and clearly a bigger is better first mover advantage. And Afterpay seems to have done spectacularly from a very rapid start. Taking that to its logical end, how are you not nervous that somebody else is going to leapfrog Afterpay who has a better mousetrap?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think that at this point they've established, because there is that verb among young people now of just Afterpaying for it, there actually are other small Me Too offerings that I didn't mention here. You know, if you're a retailer, you want to give your customers different options to pay, but you probably, from a tech standpoint, only want to deal with so many. And from a shelf space standpoint, there's only so much. And the reality is, if I'm a retailer and I look and say, well, Afterpay has roughly 3 to 4x the number of Zip customers, do we really need Zip here in our checkout experience? And while there are some stores that have both, just like they'll accept a Visa or MasterCard, I think that the Visa here in this equation is Afterpay, and I think that they're likely to keep that position just because the first mover advantage.
And I believe you did touch upon the possibility, you brought up the M&A behavior at a different American company. I forget the company's name, but it was a PayPal Mafia gentleman who sold the company. Going to the logical endpoint, what is the buyer in a hypothetical scenario actually acquiring? Is someone going after members versus talent and people and engineering staff? What is potentially being acquired, and what does Afterpay truly have?
Yeah, good question. I think domestically, so if we're talking about a domestic buyer, someone, I could see one of the big banks being interested, and they could look at this and say, this is a way for us to get better access to small loans and a cost-effective way for us to do it and get pretty attractive returns on that. And there are four big banks here, and I could see any one of them being interested. And to that end, Westpac's investment in Zip probably speaks to the interest there. If you are a PayPal, I think your rationale would be, Australia is nice, but we want to take this model and export it. Now, I think if that's the approach, I think that these guys, Afterpay, need to demonstrate some success, or at least an entrance and some traction into the U.S. So I'm not banking on a takeout there, but I think if they did move in and get some traction, I would not be surprised if PayPal said, all right, fine, we're going to buy this, we're going to scale it, and we're going to roll this out to a ton of merchants, and we will make it far larger ourselves with our network.
I think this the same question, slightly different angle. To what degree are you concerned about key man risk, where there might be some specially talented engineers or other people who are central to the business development who could possibly go somewhere else?
Yeah, good question. I think Nick, the head of the Afterpay business, he's an important part strategically. He's very sharp. They're also very patient, and they haven't hit the gas pedal as hard as I think a lot of, frankly, American companies would. He would be a considerable loss. And because of the growth here, management matters most when you're dealing with high reinvestment rates and rapid growth. So I would be very concerned if he got hit by a bus tomorrow for whatever reason. But the nice thing with the domestic opportunity, at least in the core market, is that because they've got the algorithms built, they've got the transaction engine running, the more data that flows through it, the smarter it should get. And I don't think you'll need rocket scientists to see those improvements. So that's domestically within that core market. I'm not too concerned about key man risk. I think it's the larger market opportunities where you're facing more strategic decisions where I would be concerned if you or Anthony Eisen, the executive chairman, who I think is brings a lot of great perspective and experience, if he got hit by a bus for whatever reason, I'd be concerned.
If we could please move to slide 19, which is seven slides forward, I believe. Speaking of the management team, I'd love to better understand, is there a history of insider buying? And if so, are we seeing activity on the inside that triangulates with the thesis?
Yeah, good question. The short answer is no, but for context, Nick is a pretty young guy, so I'm guessing he probably would not have a lot of cash to be going out and buy more. But as I said, there also hasn't been, I mean, they were comfortable with a two-year lockup and they own such a big chunk of the company that I think there's quite a bit of skin in the game. And we'll learn more after the escrow rolls off in May. But I think the amount of money they have in this is enough to keep them very hungry.
And I'm seeing a commentary on the strong alignment. I'd love to explore to whatever degree you think is appropriate, insider incentives. Is there public disclosure of the KPIs or the metrics that help determine the bonus compensation?
There is. The disclosures around that in Australia don't tend to be quite as robust as they are in the US. So there's not as much to work with there. The incentive structure here is option driven, which is, I guess, perhaps not too surprising. Overall, though, I think really you're banking more on just the ownership stake being the driving force. And yesterday I was looking at a US large cap, which I think is a great business, and was trying to size up alignment incentives, and was just reminded of how different a structure it is when I'm dealing with an Aussie small, where you get a company that, you know, might be almost a quarter owned by the founders, and that's your incentive and alignment right there. But yeah, I think ultimately that's going to be the driving force and what keeps them focused.
I'd love to move forward one slide to the next slide about Afterpay economics, please. I'm curious of these different metrics you've brought to our attention. If you have any thoughts about the long-term directionality, what the levels might be in 5-10 years from now.
Yeah, sure. I think there will be long-term pressure on the take rate, and that'll be a combination of probably just long-term competitive pressure, but also after a lot of Afterpay's customers today are smaller, and they might pay maybe a 6% ticket to Afterpay, but the larger ones will pay more like 3. So it's there's a very big spread there. And I think as they take on bigger customers, as they hopefully will, that will shrink. I think as they continue to grow, they've said that their loss rate, they're not guiding, and this is kind of Jim Sinegal or Amazon, or Jeff Bezos-esque, they're not guiding for specific margin, they're guiding for maximum profitability. So around loss rates, they're happy to toggle that and perhaps take a higher loss rate if it were to mean doing a significantly number higher of transactions. So I expect that number will bounce around a decent bit over time as they kind of experiment with that. So in one sense, I could see that number going up. I mean, obviously if there was a recession of some kind, it probably would. But I could also see them basically moving from, well, right now we're saying no to 25% of transactions, but if we bump that to 80, then, we're saying no to 25. If we lower that to 20 or 15, we're going to take higher losses, but overall the net incremental improvement would be favorable. So I guess it's kind of a hard one to just look at in a pure margin term, but broadly, I think you'll see take rates slide down and transaction margins, if loss rates improve, transaction margins might also slide, but hopefully that means greater volume.
And if we could please move forward two slides to the operating and financial data on slide 22. Mm-hmm. I am noticing that there's $93 million of merchant fees, which are up 300%, which is terrific and presumably very high margin revenue. I think it's also possible to invert the same data point to argue there's a very high level of friction at a total dollar level, which might create a your margins are opportunity for a lower cost alternative, such as maybe Bitcoin, just to throw it out there. How do you think through the risk of some other technology that has less friction emerging?
I'm less concerned about a different technology popping up. Payments are just such a tough nut to crack. I mean, there's a graveyard of payment companies, and when Afterpay initially listed, I was actually really skeptical because I was like, they're just never going to reach scale. And I did not at all consider the growth that they would post on both sides of the network. So I'm generally very skeptical. And this is ironic, right? Given what I'm pitching, but generally, very few payment companies get that escape velocity and network effect. And I'm not too concerned about that or Bitcoin. Just the Bitcoin, despite all the, I don't know about you, but it seems to be all anyone talks about here, anyone I talk to here in markets. Very few people actually pay with it, and payment systems aren't really geared around it. So that is a long-term secular threat to the broader channel. But even with Afterpay, you need like a Bitcoin buy now, bit later rival to kind of upset the apple cart on their model. Now, I think the more specific threat to margins is probably PayPal and PayPal Credit. So PayPal Credit hasn't really been a thing here in Australia. As Afterpay moves into other markets, namely the US, I think you're gonna see more competition at the margin line in the US than you will in Australia, which is it's called the em it's known, I believe it's called the Emerald Isle, and partially because margins are so high here. You'll see pressure around that. So one thing I wouldn't do is just extrapolate, well, if they can get this net transaction rate and multiply that into the States, I think you need to haircut it some. So that's a valid concern, I think more so with the international opportunities than domestic.
And moving to slide 25, so three slides forward, please, the key risks. I'd love to ask which of these risks would you say is most front and center on your mind?
The recession one is, from a risk management standpoint, is a PM, the one that I'm cognizant of. So I think there's probably just, I mean, there's credit risk here, and I generally dislike credit risk. But for context, Australia's market is incredibly financial sector heavy. So at the fund level, we are considerably underweight financials here in Australia. There is credit risk here, and that's probably the part that, my long tail worry of, I don't think China's economy is probably quite as strong as a lot of people might think. I worry about credit in China. I worry sometimes about balance sheets and households in Australia. So that would probably be the one that, if I had to keep me up at night, it'd be that one. Regulatory, it's more of a wild card because I don't know where the chips will fall. And I think overall, they're in a good place. And in my experience, most concerns about changes in regulation tend to be overblown. Now, there can be a structural change that happens, but given that Afterpay seems to be a very user-centric business that seems to do pretty right by customers who might otherwise not be able to get credit or get it at, maybe borrow from a big bank at a 30% APR and still pay late fees if they're behind. I think they'll land in a good place there. I could be wrong, but I think they will.
If we could please turn back to slide number four, which has the Lakehouse Capital, the two funds, overview.
Cool.
You have been remarkably generous with your time, and we know your time is valuable and limited, so thank you for being so giving to our community. I'd like to ask what type of feedback could be most helpful to receive?
Sure. So two things spring to mind. The first is, if you have any specific feedback on Afterpay, I'm more than happy to hear it. And my email, by the way, is jmager, just first initial last name at lakehousecapital.com.au. I'd love to hear any feedback you've got. You won't hurt my feelings, and anything you tell me hopefully would sharpen the saw, and I'll learn something new. So I very much appreciate it, particularly if you disagree. The second thing would be, we have a pretty differentiated style, particularly here within Australia. If you happen to be in Australia and you like our approach or style, I'd love to get coffee sometime. This is a fairly small market. We're based here in Sydney, and if nothing else, it'd be fun to just bat around ideas. And, longer term, we're a growing business and always on the lookout for talent. So even if you just want to have a casual chat and just say good day, feel free to shoot me an email. It'd be great.
And one more time, what's the email address, please?
JMAG. JMAGYER at lakehousecapital.com.au.
On that note, Joe, one more time, thank you for choosing to be here at Best Ideas 2018. It is an honor to learn from you, and we very much hope to see you back in the future. Have a great day.
Thanks, Jack. Yeah, I really appreciate it.